Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. The Dow had a negative week, but AI is keeping the S&P on the positive side. Ross takes a look at gold, crude, and the sliding Canadian dollar. He also has a special offer for our listeners. Author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Bursts, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash, Hilliard Macbeth, tells us the latest Bank of Canada rate cut shows the Canadian economy is in trouble, even if the government won't admit it. He points out Toronto is already seeing a major correction in housing prices. He also weighs in on whether Canada should join the United States. Founder of thetrendletter.com, Martin Straith, talks to us about whether the S&P is close to topping out. Should investors be more cautious going into the new year? And what could Trump tariffs mean for inflation? He also has a special offer for our listeners. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Glad to be with you, Jim.
How would you describe what's going on in the stock markets right now as we near Christmas?
Well, here we are, you know, a week and a half to Christmas, and we've had a little pause in the broad indices. Actually, the Dow had a pretty rough week, but the S&P's holding in, and the AI stocks are on a roll. There's a real speculative frenzy happening out there, and you know, I think back to some previous years when you got this real excitement going into the end of the year in specific areas, and just think back to when Bitcoin was coming to life. And I remember back in 2017, that Christmas, the talk at every meeting that you went to or dinner or a cocktail party at around Christmas was all about Bitcoin. And no sooner had it become the talk of the town at 20,000 than it was back to 11,000 2 months later, and at 3,000 another 6 months after that. So here we are right now. You've got this speculative group that are on the run again. Bitcoin is up over 100,000, getting weekly overbought signals in there, the same ones that we had back in 2017 and in 2021. So there's some vulnerability, maybe a possibility. And then you look at things like Reddit or Robinhood, the same type of thing, excesses that we haven't seen in either one of those in a couple of years in Robinhood, and Reddit's much more recently. It just hasn't been around that long. You take a look at the brokers that the online brokerages like Interactive Brokers getting overbought signals there. So all of these items I've mentioned, they are up, they've doubled in price since August. So that tells you just, you know, how much froth there is out there. Another, you know, name that's in that same list is Tesla, which is not so much a car company as it is in the AI field. And, you know, things like Destiny 100, this thing is up, you know, way over 100% in the last couple of weeks. So the excitement is there, and it's something that you have to be wary of, especially as you get into the second half of December, because we've had a lot of important tops over the years. Around the end of the year, you think about Japan. Back in 1989, you got the stock market, the gold market in 1979. There's just a number of them out there that have sort of run their course and had big corrections after that. So you know, once we get this seasonal play out of the way right now, where we have this strength, and it's mild right now because I think there was a lot of front running after the U.S. election, a lot of strength there in the first couple of weeks. And so we're getting more of a grinding up for the broad markets, but it's the speculative group that are catching all the headlines.
What's happening with gold?
The Chinese told us this week that the bank there was back into buying gold. So what did we get? We got a spurt in gold that took us up into the early part of the week. And by the time we got towards the end of the week, it's starting to come under some pressure here. You see that over in the silver market as well. Silver actually closed below some support areas. The gold is still managing to just hold in. The miners are holding in reasonably well at this point. And we've been looking at the silver miners, the SIL ETF. That one went up and tested resistance at $40 in the last couple of weeks. I think that once we get into the stronger part of the seasonal, which usually occurs starting usually in the last week of December, that if you see silver, the SIL break out through 40, you might want to grab that and get on board.
What's going on in the crude oil market?
Crude, as you know, I've been looking at this support level and thinking that it would be violated, and it hasn't. This week, OPEC came along and has decided that they're going to do a cut in the supply. So now we've got it pushing up through the $70 level without any trouble. We're up at 72. Looks as though it might have some legs. So we'll watch this one pretty closely over the next week or two.
What's happening on the currency front?
On the currencies, the U.S. dollar is just biding its time. It's only given back a quarter of the run that it had from the summer low. Flirted around the 20-week moving average and has been fairly buoyant since then. So it looks as though it's still got some upside room, and maybe up into the 107 to 108 bracket might be possible. And wouldn't be at all surprised if you see that run in the early part of the year. On the other side of the coin, the weakest currency out there is the Canadian dollar. And as anticipated, the Bank of Canada in the middle of the week dropped interest rates by another 50 basis points. That was in the cards. Market had very little reaction on the day of the news, but it eroded away to close at 70 and a quarter at the end of the week. This is the lowest that we've seen, the lowest weekly close in over 22 years on the Canadian dollar. And this comes, you know, at a time when the CRB index, Commodity Research Bureau index, which has, you know, a broad basket of agricultural as well as energy commodities in it. Both of those indices, the CRB and the crude oil, have been walking up through this week, they are now in sort of short-term established uptrends, whereas the Canadian just, you know, can't not only keep up with it, it just gives up ground on the downside. So it's heavy. Technically, though, we are 9 weeks now. Actually, I guess it's 10 weeks where we've been having consecutive lower weekly closes, and that puts us into a position where we could easily get a decent bounce out of here, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if you see a good maybe 2-2.5 cent rally on the Canadian dollar as it works its way, you know, grinds its way lower.
Ross, anything to cheer up our listeners for the holidays?
Well, they can have 25% off an annual subscription if they take that out by going to the website, chartsandmarkets.com.
Ross, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Pleasure to be back, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from ChartsAndMarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Hilliard Macbeth next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and financial advisor in Edmonton, Alberta. His website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Nice to be back.
Well, the second edition of your book, When the Bubble Bursts, is now on sale. Would it make a great stocking stuffer?
I think it would, because of the change in the market. You know, for up until recently, the interest kind of dimmed a little bit, although they're still selling. But now that the market has changed and it's starting to come down, there's a renewed interest in, how long is it going to take for the bubble to burst and how low are prices going to go and all that. And it's all in the book. So that'd be probably something that people would like to hear.
This week, the Bank of Canada dropped its rate to 3.25%. Is this a sign Canada's economy is in trouble?
Well, Canada's economy is definitely in trouble. And I don't know if the Bank of Canada would admit it, but they went on a cutting spree. They started before the U.S. did, and they cut several times. And then the last two times, they cut 50 basis points each time. So at the press conference they had, I guess, yesterday when they made the second 50 basis point cut. So it's a total of almost, they started at 5, and now they've dropped it 1.75%. So they've basically dropped it down to where probably they're thinking about stopping the cuts. But so they talked about moderating the cuts, in other words, slowing down the rate of cuts, and the inflation rate has come down to 2%. But the ex-governor, Stephen Pelosi, announced in the media that Canada's already in a recession. So that kind of leaves the current central bank people in a bit of a bind. So if Canada's in a recession, they could keep cutting more. In some countries, in one country in Europe, Switzerland, they're talking about moving rates all the way back down to zero again. So if the recession turns out to be a really bad one, then the cuts will probably keep going for a while longer.
Could government incentives keep house prices from crashing?
I don't think so. I think that the problem is that, just take, for example, the glut of condos in Toronto. They've got so many condos, and now the price these prices were set 3 years ago when the people put down their deposit, pre-construction condos sales, and they're paying $1,500 a square foot. And now there's perfectly good condos that have been around for maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years. They're selling for $900 a square foot. So there's a gap there that's just enormous. And so that overflow is way more significant than anything that the government might be doing on a short-term temporary basis to try and stimulate the housing market. There's a huge overhang to work through, and that basically only gets resolved when a bubble bursts.
Could we see bidding wars and higher prices like there was back in 2022?
You know, I don't think so. I don't, you know, for one thing, the interest rates, I was talking to people and they said they got 1.5% interest rates on their mortgage. So one of the misconceptions is that the bank account is cut, as we just talked about, a lot, but mortgage rates don't necessarily come down. In fact, mortgage rates are more determined by the 5-year government account of bond rate, and that hasn't come down nearly as much. So if mortgage rates stay as high as they are now, even if the government puts in some special measures like 30-year amortization and all that, I don't think it's going to be enough to get it back into the bidding war game again.
When will it be likely a good time to buy a home?
Well, that's a question that I'm getting a lot. And I see all this stuff about, well, okay, now we're in the correction phase, and everybody seems to be okay with that. The peak now looks like it was 2022. The prices have come down 10 to 20% since then. So that's coming up to 3 years now. And normally people might say, well, 3 years, that must be just about be over. No, I don't think so. I think what we have to look at is the correction that's needed to get prices down to where affordability happens again. And that could be another one or two or three more years, and another 20 or 30% lower on prices. So we've got a ways to go yet.
Is it a good time for the bank of mom and dad to be giving their sons and daughters money so they can buy a home?
No. In a word, no. I mean, like, it's just crazy the amount of debt people have, because prices haven't come down that much yet. And the unemployment rate in Canada is 6.8%, is rising. It's going to go higher. And young people are often the first people to get laid off. They just be getting them into a debt that probably, if one or both of them gets laid off, they wouldn't be able to hang on to. And then, so it isn't just the down payment the bank of mom and dad is getting into. They might get into where they have to make the mortgage payments too. And you know, that could threaten their retirement. So no, I would say absolutely not.
What's the latest on Canada's housing bubble?
So as I mentioned, the prices peaked in 2022. They're down in some suburbs of Toronto. They're down 20 or 30%. Overall, the numbers are you know, and there's a problem because there's different. There's condos and there's single family homes and there's new construction and all that. But let's say 15 to 20%. And so it's an ongoing thing. And I think we have to be patient because we're going to see a lot more before it's finished.
We're hearing Canada could have a $60 billion deficit this year. What could that mean for the Canadian dollar, the economy, and real estate?
Well, so the deficit, so the to get in 2020, when they went crazy and panicked, they ran a $500 billion deficit. So this is slightly more than 10% of the deficit that they ran, and that was only for 1 year. $60 billion is still higher, though, compared to the years before 2020, before we did the crazy COVID thing. But it's not that significant compared to the U.S. The U.S. deficit is much, much bigger. The U.S. deficit is $2 trillion. So if you take a 10-to-1 ratio between the two countries, you'd have to be looking at a deficit that was probably triple what we have in Canada. So the deficit is not the problem. The bigger problem is going to be if unemployment keeps rising and if the U.S. government gets into a recession, and that's what we're looking at in the next little while. Is we have to worry about what happens when the U.S. government tries to solve their deficit. If they cut back from $2 trillion deficit to $1 trillion deficit, that's taking $1 trillion out of the economy, which is like 5% of the total economy, which would be a very recessionary move.
How are Christmas retail sales doing so far?
You know, I don't know. I really don't follow that. If you listen to the media on Black Friday, as they call it, the day, you know, when they call it Black Friday, by the way, because that's the day the retailers are supposed to be turning a profit. But, you know, store traffic wasn't as good. So then they talked about, well, on the Mondays when they have the online sales. But nobody really knows. The retail sales in Canada are very poor. Because remember, when you see the number recorded for retail sales, it's not adjusted for inflation. So if they say retail sales were flat year over year, that means they're actually down 2 or 3% when you adjust for the amount of inflation that's in the prices of the retail things that people buy. So it's, you know, we're probably in a recession, and it's going to be a soft Christmas for the retailers, I'm sure. You don't see the bankruptcies until January, so that's what you could watch for in January. You could see a lot of bankruptcies in the Canadian and to some extent in the U.S. retail market as well.
Canada's holiday sales tax break, is this designed to help an economy in trouble?
Well, it's certainly a sign the economy's in trouble, but I don't know. I saw this GST break. It's so much trouble for the small business person that some of them are thinking about shutting down. Even I saw online an account where people said they're going to shut down their company because it's too difficult for them to reprogram their computers to handle the temporary holiday. It's not worth it for them to reprogram the computer for such a short period of time. So it wasn't well thought out. I think it's not going to make any difference. And it's just going to be a big irritation to a lot of small business retailers that have to figure out how to cope with it.
That's a break for me. My birthday dinner won't have GST on it.
There you go.
Yeah. Whoopee, folks. Yeah, celebrate. Well, I guess it might cover the cost of one drink.
Yeah.
It might. President Trump's threatening 25% tariffs on Canadian goods if Canada doesn't put a halt to cross-border drug trafficking, especially fentanyl, and the flow of migrants. Prime Minister Trudeau says Canada will retaliate. What could Trudeau's retaliation do to Canada's economy?
So the problem with the retaliation is that Canada's very dependent on international trade. We're like 40% of our economy is trade. Like, that includes imports and exports. The U.S. is not. The U.S. is only 10% dependent on foreign trade. The U.S. could cancel their foreign trade tomorrow. It wouldn't really make that much difference to them. They've got a very self-sustaining economy. So if you start going trading, like, you know, in a chess game, you start trading pieces for pieces. Well, we're already down three pieces. So if we use an analogy, if we start trading pieces for pieces, we're going to run out of pieces long before the U.S. does. And so we have to negotiate. We can't really do a retaliation. Now, looking back, when the last time I did check back, and the last time we did have a big disagreement, the big trade tariff thing was actually in the early 1930s, the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, and Canada did retaliate because it's impossible with the political pressure built to such a high degree that they have to retaliate. But they probably retaliate on something that doesn't matter that much to the Americans and try not to irritate them too much. We're really in a position with a very weak hand when it comes to that. So probably the Prime Minister did the right thing by going to Mar-a-Lago and trying to meet with Trudeau. Whether it has any impact, I don't know. Like, shortly after that meeting, Trump started talking about Canada becoming the 51st state. So which is ridiculous, by the way. And so I don't know what's going to happen. It's hopefully he was just musing about 25% tariffs and he doesn't actually do it.
Well, I thought in a trade war, Canada talking about withholding oil or uranium. We also have rare earths that China is now threatening to hold back or is holding back. But I think where Canada really could hurt the U.S. is withholding French fries. Canada supplies 75% of the French fries to the U.S. That's something the average American would notice.
Yeah, they would. If they couldn't get that poutine, they'd be really upset. And also, what about maple syrup? We could do a maple syrup ban and see if that worked as well.
I think they notice the French fries more. President Trump mentioned Canada becoming the 51st state and has been trolling Governor Trudeau. Canada has 10 provinces, 3 territories, which could be an extra 13 states. Could there be pros and cons to Canada and the U.S. merging?
Well, if Canada and the U.S. let's just say the more likely would be one state, right? So we'd all have to be one state of the union, and we'd have about 40 million people, which is about the size of California. It happens to be about the same. The problem is that the Republicans will never go for it because almost for sure that one state would vote more left-wing than the current states. In other words, it would be on the Democrat side, not on the Republican side. So they would lose the electoral votes that California has. I forget exactly how many, but California has more electoral votes than any other state. So maybe New York. So New York and California are the big bastions of Democrat support. And if you added Canada, then basically it would mean that all the elections in the future would go to the Democrats and the Republicans would lose. So there's no way it's going to happen. And unless they annexed us and didn't give us any electoral votes, which is, you know, who knows what the thing is, but it's just not going to happen. But they certainly could. Canada is in a position to withhold oil and also water. There's a lot of water that goes down from the Columbia River down into the U.S. It's very important to those that part of the northwestern part of the U.S. But those kind of actions are very upsetting to the U.S., and there would definitely be some pretty major retaliation if we tried to pull that.
Bitcoin's trading around $100,000 U.S. What are your thoughts on Bitcoin and cryptos?
So I don't understand what you get when you buy a cryptocurrency, a Bitcoin. Like, you get a Bitcoin, and somebody's promised that there's never going to be more than 21 million of them. And it's at 19 million or something like that now. And the way they add them with the computer, you have to do a lot of work with your computer to get a Bitcoin. So they're adding much, much more slowly. And then at that point, allegedly, there's no more Bitcoin being created. So that's a way of making it some scarcity and then might become valuable. But unless people adopt it as a store of value, it's not going to have any value. As far as I know, there's no interest or dividend income coming off it. So it would have to replace the currency, like the U.S. dollar, the Canadian dollar, the euro, the Chinese yuan, Japanese yen. And I just don't see the government's doing that. So I wouldn't buy it. It's entirely a speculation based on, and I actually coincidentally checked recently, and it's almost 90% retail. Like, there's very, very little participation among pension plans and life insurance companies and all that sort of institutional money, which is by far the largest amount of money in the stock market or in the investment market. So you've got a very tiny amount of crypto owned by real solid investors, and you've got almost all of it, like 90% of it, owned by speculators, probably mostly young people. And they're basically going to be very, very upset if it drops in value. And so there's no natural buyer if they all tried to exit in a crash in Bitcoin. So that'd be a very dangerous speculation in my mind.
The Dow and S&P 500 hit new all-time highs this month. Could the Dow and S&P continue moving higher?
So those U.S. markets are very overvalued. I know we've talked about this several times over the last couple of years, and they just keep getting more and more expensive. And compared to every other market in the world, they're expensive. And compared to the history of the U.S. market, they're also very expensive. So it's unlikely that those valuations will last. Which is basically impossible that they were lost. So there's only a couple of ways that they could keep the prices up this high. That would be that the earnings that underpins the valuation would have to grow very rapidly. But the U.S. hasn't had a recession for a long time and is overdue for a recession. In fact, the only reason I think the U.S. isn't in a recession now is that they're running a deficit of $2 trillion, which is a huge, I mean, it's like 7-8% of the economy, right? So once they try and trim that back, and they appointed Elon Musk and another guy named Vivek Ramaswamy, I think I may not have that last name correct. Once they start cutting, they'll cut the deficit, but they'll also impact the economy. So the next recession, the stock market was going to be a lot cheaper, and that would be a much better time to look at buying it.
Does gold look like it's getting ready to move higher?
Gold's been very strong. You know, and think about how strong gold is when you think about the fact that the U.S. dollar has been very strong. So U.S. dollar's been strong. Usually gold would struggle with that, but gold's been, you know, it's sort of 2,700. It's, you know, it hit a high higher than that, but it's pretty close, still pretty close to that high. And there isn't widespread belief in gold yet. I mean, gold's got a long way to go because you've got all the crypto people that don't believe in gold, they believe in crypto. And you've got a lot of people that have money in the stock market, but they're not frightened in a way that would cause them to switch to gold. So there's a lot of potential new buyers coming into the gold market who aren't there now. And so I would think it would. So the old high was in 1980. It was $850 an ounce. But if you adjust for inflation, I think it works out to about $3,300. So it's about $600 under that. So it's about 20% below its inflation-adjusted high that happened a long, long time ago. So I would think it would at least run through that and make a new inflation-adjusted high at some point. It might take a year or two. It might only take a month. Who knows? But that's the direction it's headed, in my opinion.
The U.S. dollar had a pullback. Does it look like the U.S. dollar is moving higher now, possibly in sync with gold?
Yeah, the U.S. dollar has been generally pretty strong. It, you know, that's one of the things that's really hurting the Canadian dollar is the strength of the U.S. dollar. You know, if the interest rates go up in the U.S. because there's tariffs put on, which means inflation goes higher, the U.S. dollar could get even stronger. And it's very, very hard on countries like Canada and other countries for investors, because the investors will pull all their money back into the U.S. and that just compounds the problem. As I mentioned before, the U.S. isn't that dependent on exports, so higher currency doesn't hurt them as much as it would a country like Canada. So I don't know where how that stops at some point. At some point it'll stop, but it probably takes a recession for the dollar to up until then it's probably going to continue to be stronger.
The Canadian dollar keeps hitting new lows not seen since the crash of 2020. Is the Canadian dollar showing any signs of bottoming?
No, it's not. It's it's very close to 70 cents, and it looks like it's headed lower, below 70 cents, and that'll be probably brought about by these rate cuts that have gone much further than the U.S. rate cuts, and the fact that we're in a recession and the U.S. is not in a recession. Now, I think eventually the U.S. will also be in a recession, but and that would cause their currency to drop a little bit, but our currency is likely to drop more as people look at the U.S. Interest rates in the U.S. are higher than the interest rates in Canada, and the currency is stronger. So it's, you know, for international investors who don't care, but it's hard to find a reason why they would put their money into Canada and try and have a money flow into Canada that would prop up the Canadian dollar. Otherwise, it's just going to be sliding further, and then the Bank of Canada will be faced with the really difficult choice, which is should we raise interest rates to try and protect the dollar from sliding below 65 cents. And that decision's a ways away, but that's going to be a very tough decision for them.
Are you seeing signs of the housing bubble bursting in Canada?
Yeah, I think it's already started. As we talked, it's probably the peak was 2022. And, right now it wouldn't be qualifying as a crash or a bursting of a bubble. It would just be a correction. But it's the start of a pretty major correction, which eventually will be bursting the bubble. Remember that when a bubble bursts, if it's a real bubble, and we don't know yet if it is, but it sure looks like a bubble, it has to correct all of the excess increase in pricing that happened since the bubble started to form. Well, the bubble started to form in like 2003, so we're now 22 years later, and the excess is pretty substantial. I mean, we need a correction in the range of 40 or 50% in house prices to erase all of those excess gains that we've had. So yes, we're in a bubble, but it's just the very early stages of the correction of the bursting of the bubble.
Clusters of towers being built in urban areas in Canada. Do you think Canada will be drawn, or Canadians will be drawn to live in these tower clusters, or will these condos mainly be a product for investors?
So the investment in a condo is just a terrible investment. And just very briefly, I'll explain why. In a condo, a high-rise condo we're talking about, in towers, so high-rise, only about 10 to 20% of the value of the total project is in the land. 80 to 90% of it's in the building. And the building, as soon as it's completed and people start moving in, starts to deteriorate or depreciate. And most of these high-rise towers that have been built recently have major construction flaws and lawsuits and all that sort of stuff, which hurts the valuation as well. So that tiny little bit of land that's under this very tall tower, that's the only part of the equation where you get long-term appreciation is in the value of the land. And so people are going to get pretty fed up with living in these high-rise condos, paying for special assessments and, condo fees and special claims, cash calls that fix a balcony that's broken or something, or water leaking somewhere, is not going to work as an investment. The only way it would work as an investment is if the land appreciated like four or five times faster than the building was depreciating, and that's just not possible. So they're terrible investments, and the question becomes, if they get cheap enough, will people want to live in them? It's possible, because the single-family home might still be worth $2 million and the condo might have dropped from $1 million down to $500,000. So it might be a way of monetizing the gain in the single-family home. But other than that, investors are just getting killed. Every month they're paying out more than they're getting in a form of rent, and I don't think the investors are going to be interested in that for any length of time.
Do you think the electric vehicle market is starting to overcome some of its growing pains?
Well, you know, the thing is that the electric vehicle market needs some new models. So the Tesla, the Tesla is coming out apparently with a new model and a cheaper model in early 2025. They've refreshed the Model 3, but it's made in China, so there's a big tariff on that. It can't get it. For the electric vehicle market to regain its momentum, because it's kind of stalled out now, it's still growing in worldwide. The numbers are still very good, but in North America, people that were going to buy a Tesla kind of have now, and there aren't any exciting new models. There's one company called Lucid that makes a very good car, but it's very expensive. It's way more expensive than the most expensive Tesla. So we need a couple of new models in North America, because the U.S. is the biggest car market in the world. We need a non-Tesla, affordable electric car in the U.S. Now, China's got several models that would work tomorrow. They're great cars. The manufacturing is excellent. But Trump and his cohorts don't want to see Chinese cars coming into the U.S. So we need a domestic, maybe a Buick or a Chev or something like that, that people can buy, or a truck. Maybe a truck would work too. I don't know. And it just hasn't happened. But it will happen. When they finally figure out how to do it, somebody will figure it out, and there'll be a new surge of popularity coming. Because there's a lot of people that now, they're so upset with Elon Musk, they say, I don't want to buy a Tesla because of Elon Musk, right? So they need to find an alternative that they can buy. Maybe a Volkswagen or a Volvo or something like that, that they can accept living with that one. But yeah, it'll happen. It's just a question right now. It's sort of like a pause in the growth rate.
Where can people follow you?
So I'm on Twitter, formerly, or X, formerly known as Twitter, HMACBE. And I'm also on Blue Sky now, which is a new alternative to Twitter. And then if people want to just look up my website, Macbeth McLeod Partners, they can sign up to the weekly blog post. They can get sent directly into their emails. It's free for now. So, those are the best ways to do it. And of course, I encourage people to read the book now that the bubble's bursting. It's getting more timely than it was when it first came out.
Hilliard, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thanks for having me on, Jim.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. Coming up, Martin Strath, next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Martin Strath, founder of Trend News Online at TheTrendLetter.com. He's speaking to us from Coquitlam, B.C., which is just east of Vancouver. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Oh, well, thank you, Jim. Good to be here.
You posted an interesting chart Wednesday on the S&P 500 showing that it could be nearing a market top. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, what we do is we're technical analysts, and so we watch trends, and the key to our work is to identify, you know, when we see a change in trend. You know, there's a great saying, you know, the trend is your friend until it ends. So we look at when a trend ends, whether either an uptrend or a downtrend. Now, the chart I posted on Wednesday, so that was of the S&P 500 since late October to the current level. By the way, Jim, that chart, your listeners can check it out on our blog section on our website. So just go to thetrendletter.com and blogs, and you can see that chart there. But on the chart, you know, it's, you know, very, you know, trend, you know, technical analysis, it's all about trend lines, and simply drew a trend line from October 23 low and then connected it to, you know, a series of lows and extended that right through to the current level of the S&P 500. And anybody that looks at the chart, you're going to clearly see that it becomes very apparent that the trend line acted as very strong support each time it was tested. So it was tested twice in April 24, and then again in late May. But in August 24, you know, if somebody's looking at that trend line, you're going to see that it was breached. And we had that, you know, you'll remember the, you know, the Japanese carry trade, you know, the fear that rattled all the global markets. So now the key point I wanted to illustrate from that chart is that ever since that breach in August, the S&P 500 has not been able to move above that trend line ever since. So the S&P 500 has made four attempts since August to break through that resistance level, but it has failed each time. So now we've got December coming up, which is a very strong seasonal period for the S&P 500. And, you know, we typically get the Santa Claus rally. So if we cannot break through this trend line during this exceptionally bullish seasonal period, this could be, you know, pointing to a potential top in January. Now, you know, there's no guarantee this is going to happen, but it's something we're really keeping a close eye on because, again, when we see a trend line get challenged and broken, we need to see it break back above that trend line or things could turn. So the question then would be, well, why would the stock market top out in January? You know, especially, you know, given that Trump's about to take over, I think his inauguration, the 20th, is it? But so one of the answers could simply be that the market's already priced in all of these positive effects of, you know, the expected economic policies. You know, corporate taxes dropping from 35% to 21%, you know, deregulation in energy and financials and, you know, manufacturing. You know, just that general pro-growth, more infrastructure spending, support for small businesses. So all these, you know, trade policies that are theoretically, you know, positive for Americans to buy U.S. goods. And then, of course, you know, the most ambitious plan they got is to reduce the size of government and cut, you know, wasteful spending. But, you know, so that's all pumped up the market up to now. But, you know, it's one thing to want to do all of these things, and then there's another to actually getting them done. And I think that unless Trump comes out, you know, comes out of the gate swinging and start actually putting these policies in place right at the beginning, there's going to be some realization that, that this is a very ambitious slate of policies, and getting them done is going to take, you know, much longer than the market was hoping for. So it could simply be a case of, you know, the old buy the rumor, sell the news. You know, all the hype's already baked in, and once he takes office, I think there could be some real letdown and some selling. So if the S&P 500 fails to break through this uptrend, we could see, you know, a temporary, at least a temporary market top, and I'm expecting that, you know, anytime over the next month or so. So given this incredibly bullish settlement, if we do get a sharp correction, I think that's going to give the markets quite a shock.
Given what you just outlined, should investors be getting more cautious going into 2025?
Sorry, I sort of broke up there, Jim. Yeah, so as I said, you know, we're technical analysts. We watch for potential trend changes and then act when we see them actually come into fruition. So that scenario I just outlined, again, that's a potential scenario we're watching closely. You know, but the key is the stock market, you know, over time, it goes up. But it doesn't go up all the time. So on average, you know, it goes up about 10%. But that's, again, that's an average. And any given year, it can rise dramatically higher or it can fall dramatically lower. So if we look at just this current year, 2024, which is just wrapping up, right now, like if we're including dividends, the S&P 500 is up almost 30% this year. So, you know, that's far above that 10% average. And then, you know, that would sound abnormally high, but it's really not that unusual. You know, I was just reading some research the other day, and since 1928, so what are we talking? We're talking like 96 years of data. The S&P 500 finished with a total return above 25% in 26 of those 96 years. So that's, you know, that's 27% of the time. So we will get these wild swings, both up and down. So we tend to be contrarian. So, you know, we look, when everybody's on one side of the trade, we start to look for indicators that that trend is changing. And one of the toughest things for most investors to do is to be ready to embrace change. You know, you could always remember Buffett's, you know, line, you know, be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful. Well, right now, everyone is greedy. You know, they're all on one side of the boat here. And now, that doesn't mean the boat's going to tip over today. But it does tell us you want to start planning not to be a victim if this thing does slip over. Because we know at some point this boat will tip over because you eventually run out of buyers. And so far, you know, in this big bull market, every dip we've had, you know, buyers have rushed in. And that can go on for a long time. You know, John Maynard Keynes, you know, his great line was, what was it? The markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. But eventually, we will see a correction. Something always spooks the markets. You know, we just discussed, you know, back in August, we had that fear of the unwinding of the yen carry trade. That spilled over to all the global markets, including the U.S. markets. We saw the volatility, the VIX index, it spiked to over 65. I mean, that was the highest level since during COVID. But since then, since that low in August, you know, the S&P is now up 20%. Volatility is back down to 14%, or 14, so we're reading 14. So investors, they're complacent. They're greedy right now. Seasonality is very positive for stocks in December. So, you know, we always typically get a Santa Claus rally. So right now, I would expect the markets will continue higher through to January. But as we just highlighted earlier, we're watching that trend line in the S&P 500 and going into January, and it could technically be giving us a warning of that potential market pop. And if something spooks the markets, you want to have hedging strategies to protect yourself when the market turns lower. But once that correction begins, you know, once the market starts turning lower and people start to panic, that's when you want to be ready to embrace fear. That's when you started to think, you need to start thinking, I want to be contrarian. I want to start being thinking greedy when others are being fearful. Because, you know, the best historic returns tend to follow periods of the greatest amount of fear and volatility. And so we know another panic will be coming, because it always does. So it's just a matter of time. So generally, when the trend is up, obviously you want to keep holding stocks that are rising. But in times where volatility starts picking up and the trend starts to change, you want to start to have hedging strategies. You know, you want to be able to protect your portfolio when that boat does tip over. So, you know, that can mean just simply having exit strategies to lock in gains. And that doesn't mean you have to sell all of a position, but at least you want to be thinking about, what's my exit strategy if this market does turn against me? Because I want to take some profits at least, because you want to reduce your risk. And then, of course, you can, you know, when the trend changes, you can use the, you know, hedging strategies. You know, there's these great, you know, inverse exchange traded funds that they go up when the market goes down. So they can offset losses if you want to hold on to your long position. And again, these ETFs are very easy to trade, you know, like any stock. So it's just simply a click of the mouse. And they act as insurance. So it's just like, you know, buying fire insurance for your house. So right now, you know, the trend is clearly up. That could run for, you know, that could run for another week, could run for another month, it could run for 6 months. But in January, like I said, there is this risk that some event that could change that trend. And if it happens, you want to be prepared. So, you know, what could cause such a dramatic change in trend? Well, you know, we simply talked about that, you know, buy the rumor, sell the news, where all Trump's, you know, euphoria has already been priced in. And once he takes office, that could change. You know, there'd be some basic disappointment. Or we could have a bigger thing. We could have a black swan event, you know, like we could, you know, a dramatic escalation in Ukraine or in the Middle East. You know, one thing that's disturbing us is that, you know, over the last week, we've been hearing more and more NATO talk about gearing up for a war with Russia. You know, we've got the NATO Secretary General just told all NATO countries they need to adopt what he calls a wartime mindset. And I don't know if all your listeners are aware, but, you know, NATO's got this Article 5, and that states that any country that engages in combat with, say, Russia or any other country, non-NATO country, it would mean that Canada, Russia, and all NATO nations are obligated to succumb to that country's aid. So we need to really keep an eye on this, you know, what's happening here. I mean, that could mean World War III. So there's another scenario, you know, with another big black swan event that could happen. You know, we saw the murder of the, you know, United Health CEO just recently. And there's this incredible social media feedback calling the accused killer a hero. So, you know, we've got this vigilante justice stuff starting to really spread in the States. And it keeps, I think I mentioned this on the last time I was on your show last month. There's something that keeps gnawing in the back of my mind, which is a bit frightening. You know, we've already seen two attempts on Trump's life. And I wonder if there might not be another. And what if that was successful? So if any of these scenarios we just kind of laid out here, if they happen in the next month before Trump takes office, the markets could get hit hard. It would certainly explain the technical setup we're starting to see for a potential market top in the next month or so. So we'll watch the charts, because that's all we're really going to do. I mean, these are opinions. Opinions are great, but they don't really mean anything. The charts will tell us. And we'll see if this potential change in trends materializes. And, you know, if we do going into January, then we need to be aware. So if we do see a pullback and the correction does occur, and if it is deep, then again, you want to be ready to protect your portfolio. And if things start to unravel, then you want to be ready to embrace the fear. And you want to start planning to be greedy when others are fearful.
U.S. inflation was up slightly on Wednesday, and the stock market rallied that day. Why?
Yeah, these are interesting times. Yeah, so we had inflation rise for two consecutive months, but we had the market factor in almost a 100% chance the Fed would cut rates, which, like you say, why? Like, that sounds counterintuitive. You know, the Fed fought inflation after being too slow to react after COVID. Then, in our opinion, they acted too aggressively, and they cut 50 basis points in September. And since then, since they've been cutting, you remember when they cut is usually, you know, when they're worried about the economy, when they're thinking maybe a recession's coming. You know, if they see an inflation coming, that's when they're usually tightening. So for them to see inflation rising and to be cutting at the same time, it sounds crazy. So since then, since September, the consumer price index has been rising in both October and November. So, you know, in November, it had a slight increase, so it's at 2.7% versus the expected 2.6%. And then, like you say, the markets rallied then because they're hoping for that Fed cut. And then on Thursday, we had the producer price data come out, and it was much hotter than expected. So that was rising to, 3%, which is much higher than the expected 2.6%. So you've got, you know, CPI at 2.7%. You've got the PPI at 3%. So we need to understand that when producer prices rise, those increases typically will show up in the consumer prices, but it lags. So it's going to happen in another month or 2 months. So as you just said, even though we're seeing rising inflation, the market's expecting, you know, more cuts, and the market actually rose on Thursday. Then on Wednesday. Then on Thursday, we saw the producer did come out much hotter, and then that markets gave back, and it gave back pretty much all of Wednesday's gains. Here on Friday, we're just about at the close. The market's down slightly. So it's the markets, I think, are a bit confused here. So the Fed mandate is for 2% inflation. And again, in the last 2 months, inflation's been heading the wrong way. It's been heading closer to 3% than a 2% target. I think it's going to be very interesting to see what the inflation numbers look like in December, because if the inflation numbers are higher again, and that's before we get any, you know, tariff implications, that could be another factor that could cause the markets to roll over in January, as we were talking earlier.
With Trump coming into power with all of his tariff talk, what does that mean for inflation?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think tariffs are such a bad idea. You know, if you put a 60% tariff on Chinese goods, who's going to pay that? Well, it's not going to be the Chinese exporter. It will be the U.S. company that's importing those goods. And then what's that importer going to do? Well, he's going to pass on those higher prices onto the American consumer. So, you know, that's inflationary. I mean, I get the goal that they want to convince the U.S. consumer to buy American goods. But if the American producers, you know, can't produce the equivalent goods for anything less than 30% higher than the Chinese produce it, it means that the American consumer is now going to be spending at least 30% more for these goods. Again, I mean, that's inflationary. I mean, Trump even admitted this week that tariffs can cause prices to rise. So it's going to be really interesting to see how the Fed reacts to all this going forward. You know, with inflation already rising, and if Trump makes good on his threats for all of these tariffs, so he's talking, you know, 60% on Chinese goods, 25% on Canadian and Mexican goods, I think that's going to throw a real wrench in the Fed's desire to cut rates. And if we go back to Trump's first term, remember, he was continually barking at Fed's Jerome Powell to cut rates. So, you know, he wants them to cut rates, but at the same time, he's kind of forcing inflation higher. You know, I saw that just an aside here. Trump was just asked this week if he was going to get rid of Jerome Powell. And he said if he asked Powell to leave, he probably wouldn't. But he said if he told him to leave, he probably would. Then they asked Powell, and he said he has no intention of quitting. So I think it's been really some interesting times here, Jim.
What do you see for the currency markets?
Well, you know, currencies, when you look at currencies, it's all connected. So if the U.S. dollar is rising, then most other currencies are going to decline. So this week, we had the Bank of Canada drop their prime or their Fed rate, the central rate. You know, they dropped another 50 basis points down to 3.25%. The ECB dropped their key rate 25 basis points down to 3%. The Fed's expected to cut their rate next week 25 basis points down to 4.5%. So you've got the U.S. dollar at a close to a two-year high. So it's up almost 7% since early October. And there's two key factors that have been driving the strength of the U.S. dollar. You got the U.S. stock performance and the interest rate differential. Well, you know, U.S. stocks are outperforming pretty much every country except Canada, actually. You know, so certainly outperforming Europe and outperforming the Asian stocks. So even if the Fed cuts its rates, like everybody's expecting, and the rate goes down to 4.5%, well, their rate will still be 1.25% higher than Canada and 1.5% higher than the ECB. So if we go back to those two, you know, main drivers of the U.S. dollar, strong stocks and strong bond market, well, foreign investors in Europe, they're going to look at these better returns than they have been in the U.S. stocks, and so they're going to buy them instead of their domestic stocks. Well, to do that, then they need to convert their euros to U.S. dollars in order to buy those stocks. Now, if they want to buy the U.S. bonds, they're paying a higher yield than the European bonds. Well, again, they have to convert their euros to U.S. dollars to buy bonds. So this isn't rocket science, right? It's very simple supply and demand. If I want to buy U.S. stocks, I need to convert to U.S. dollars. So each time a European or a Japanese investor wants to invest in a higher performing U.S. stocks, or they want to convert, you know, into the, you know, higher performing U.S. bonds, they need to convert their euros or their yen, and they need to buy those Canadian or those U.S. dollars to purchase those. So, you know, investors put their capital where they feel they're going to get the best return. Now, if you look at Canada, you know, things are not looking good. You know, Canada looks really gloomy here. You know, last week we had Bank of Canada, former Bank of Canada, which is Stephen Poloz. You know, he said the Canadian economy is now in a recession. You know, Canadian GDP was just, it's up not even 1.2% annually. Compare that to the U.S. GDP, that's over 2.8% annually. So that's 133% higher GDP, higher economic growth in Canada. So since late September, the Canadian dollar is now down 4.25 cents. That's 5.6%. Now we're sitting at just over 70 cents today. So we're going to be watching to see if Trump actually repeats his first term policy where he wanted a much lower U.S. dollar. You know, back then, I don't know if you remember, but he was browbeating with Powell, trying to get him to cut rates. But again, as we said, you know, inflation in the U.S. keeps rising, as it's been doing. It's going to be really tough for the Fed to cut rates. I mean, if they cut aggressively, that's going to really fuel inflation. So the Bank of Canada, on the other hand, is the opposite story. It needs to fight a recession now. And that means Bank of Canada is going to have to keep cutting rates. So longer term, I am not optimistic on the Canadian economy, meaning the Canadian dollar is going to struggle. We predicted 6 months ago it's going to drop below 70 cents in 2025. Well, it's almost there right now. You know, the previous all-time low was 62 cents. So, I mean, honestly, Jim, I think, you know, unless there's a dramatic change in, you know, economic policy in Canada, I don't see much hope for the Canadian dollar. And, you know, just think, what if Trump does impose that 25% tariff on Canadian goods? That's just going to crush the Canadian economy, crush the Canadian dollar. You know, simply put, the U.S. economy is much stronger than Canada and Europe and Asia and really the rest of the world. So as long as that remains the case, the U.S. dollar is going to remain a strong currency.
Gold struggled after Trump was elected and has not been able to test the recent high. What's the story there?
Yeah, well, you know, after the election, gold dropped, what was it, about 8% from that high, about 2,800. And then it rallied a bit from that low. But at the same time that gold sold off, you know, we have to remember Bitcoin shot higher, you know, as that Trump euphoria for Bitcoin kicked in. So I think that kind of explains good part of that initial sell-off. Now, gold was already due for a correction. I mean, it had gained, God, what was it, about 50% since November in 23. So now in the last few days, we've been seeing some bigger swings in gold. It was up Wednesday on the higher inflation reading, but then it gave back some of that on Thursday. Now, here we are on Friday. It's down, what are we looking at here? Down about 40 bucks right now here on Friday. So it's trading about 26.70. Now, I'm still bullish long-term for gold. I think we're going to see some more of this backing and filling for a while. But you got to remember, the U.S. dollar's been on the tear, and that's given gold some headwind. But I think, you know, I've been saying this for a while, you know, at extreme times, we tend to see gold and the U.S. dollar move higher together. And I think that's going to happen, and especially if we see some black swan event, like we were talking back in January. If we see that again, I think we'd see both of those move higher. So our take is that right now we're kind of in a bit of a back and fill, which is, you know, a good, healthy pullback. So we're watching key support levels. But I think your listeners, you want to be really thinking about buying gold on these dips. So when it starts testing its support levels, that's when you really want to start thinking about buying it. Because I think longer term, you know, you've got those BRIC nations. You know, they want to create a gold-backed security, you know, to reduce their reliance on the U.S. dollar. You know, we've got these governments globally with huge fiscal problems. We've got these massive debt problems in the U.S., Canada, and pretty much every developed country, and certainly the underdeveloped countries. So these debts are inflationary, and they reduce the purchasing power of currencies. And that's a real key people need to remember. And then, of course, you know, we've got central banks, you know. You know, I've talked about this a lot on your show. You know, these are, think of the ones that are not friends of the U.S. and the West. So you've got China, Russia, Iran. So ever since, you know, Russia or the U.S. pushed Russia off that SWIFT system, these other countries, they realize that, you know, the U.S. would go after their currency as well. So I think that that's all going to happen. But we just saw a report last week that showed that China has been buying up gold again, so they're back into it. Now, if we look at seasonality, you know, early December is typically a weak period for gold, so we're starting to see that now. So that's playing out as that. So gold's kind of waffling here. But from late December through to late February, gold typically does very well. So if we continue to see these pullbacks, I think it's been a great opportunity for people to add to the position. And if people that don't even have a position, it would be a good time to start thinking about getting into it. So in the bigger picture, I know I've said this on your show a lot, I expect to see gold over 3,000 in the next year. I said that about 6 months ago, and I think we're getting really close to that. So we would be adding to our position on any significant pullback here. As I say, it's trading at about 26.70. You know, the next key support to me would be about 25.90. If it attests that level and if it holds, that might be a good place to start buying.
Bitcoin hit the psychological $100,000 level last week. Is this a sign of risk-on sentiment for the markets?
Yeah, for sure. Bitcoin, I mean, well, it soared just before the election, right? As it looked like, you know, it looked like Trump was going to get in. And then it basically shot out of the cannon once the election, once the results were in. You know, it's up almost 60%. Since the election. But, you know, it remains incredibly volatile. You know, one thing that we've noticed recently, where it wasn't trading the same, but recently we're seeing Bitcoin has been moving a lot closer with the stock market than it did before. And if we look at a chart, we can see that Bitcoin is in this nice near-term uptrend channel. Now, Jim, again, I've posted this chart, actually a couple charts on our website, on the blog section. There, you know, to me, charts are always so much easier to look at than somebody explaining it. But, you know, if they can go to our blog section, they can take a look at it. But what they would see is there's this nice uptrend channel, and the upper rung of that channel is sitting at about 108,000, while the lower rung is sitting about 97.5. So as long as Bitcoin remains in that channel, it will continue to move higher. Now, here we are on Friday. It's trading at 101,000. But given the volatility of Bitcoin, if it breaks out of that channel, you know, either up or down, that could ignite a real, you know, significant move. You know, a break higher, that could sit Bitcoin on its next destination of, you know, 200,000. But a break lower could cause a significant sell-off in Bitcoin. We'll be watching Bitcoin for potential spike lower. I think that the odds are likely more for that. And again, that kind of ties into what we were talking about earlier, that we're kind of seeing that the stock market could actually roll over over the next month or so. And if Bitcoin does follow the stock market, well, then we could see Bitcoin come lower. Big key for Bitcoin, if it drops below that 97,500 level, that could be a big sell-off for Bitcoin.
What do you see ahead for crude oil?
Well, you know, oil's got, you know, it hit, what, 72.5 just after the election. You know, we warned at that time that it's probably going to drop below 70 and test its previous very strong support around 66. Well, since then, it did exactly that. It, you know, it dropped below 70, it tested 66 support. Now, that was the fifth time since September that it's tested that support, and each time that level is held. Now, it's rallied off that support now. Right now, it's trading about 70.70, so $70.70 here on Friday. You know, it's trending higher in the short term, and it's just pushed through a very near-term resistance level. Now, the next resistance would be about 72, and then, you know, there is an off chance that it could get up to 74. But anything above that level, to me, you would need to see some real geopolitical event trigger any more upside. You know, there's a lot of headwinds for oil right now. You know, you've got the strength in U.S. dollar. You got global demand is weaker, especially China. You've got OPEC that just lowered their forecast for demand for 2024 and 2025. And, you know, they postponed their plans to lift quotas. So, you know, you've got a supply surplus. And then, of course, you got Trump with his drill baby drill mantra. I mean, that would increase supply even further. So now on the other side, you know, what could cause oil to rise near term? Well, you've got some seasonality. December is actually an up month for oil. But the real seasonal strength doesn't typically start till February. You know, from February, you typically get a real nice run right up until the end of June. So right now, I think you're going to see a bunch of, you know, some volatility there for sure. Now, another, obviously, an upside for oil would be if you saw escalation in the Middle East or Russia and Ukraine. I mean, that would certainly push prices higher. But near term, like I say, I see oil prices falling after it tests either 72 or 74, and it could drop below 60. Now, that's the price of oil. But I think, you know, if we do have this Trump drill baby drill thing, one of the things that investors want to keep an eye on is you want to be looking at those, you know, exploration and production companies and pipelines. Because if there's going to be more drilling, more exploration, well, those companies will do well. And if there's going to be more oil on the market, then the pipelines will do well. And then, of course, longer term, you know, we do still see, you know, there's going to be global demand, and primarily from those emerging markets. You know, currently, the investment into this market hasn't been there, you know, at 30, 40-year lows. Now, obviously, you know, if Trump gets in and reduces all these regulations, that's going to start to turn. But I still think that, you know, the demand will continue to grow.
No one has a crystal ball, but what sectors do you think will do well in the new year?
Well, I think, you know, generally, I think you're going to see kind of continuation of what's happening recently. You know, we've got innovation, obviously, financials with reduced regulations, and I think crypto and gold will certainly do well. You know, I can see the S&P hitting, you know, 7,000 next year. So that would be like a 15%, you know, higher than today. And if we're looking at 2025, you know, we can expect certainly continued growth, but there's certainly going to be some caveats. You know, the S&P 500, their earnings are projected to be 15% higher. So you're looking at, you know, almost $280 per. So that's big. And so, like I say, you know, if we see the S&P at 7,000 by the end of 2025, that's a nice increase. I see this even if we get, you know, potential correction, like I said, in a month or so, we're going to have a correction. You know, that's inevitable. But I still think, like I said, you know, typically if you look over time, the S&P, you know, is up an average of 10% per year. So if we do get a nice correction, then that would be a great buying time, and then that should give us a nice run after that. So over the next year, like I said, I think innovation, financials, cryptos, and gold. But there is also one other sector that I got my eye on, and I mean, this is a sector that is just totally out of favor right now. You know, it's been one that has been pretty much labeled uninvestable. And we're talking about China and Chinese stocks. But if we compare Chinese stocks to U.S. stocks, I mean, there's no comparison. You know, Chinese stocks are so undervalued compared to the U.S. If you just look at simple fundamentals and financials, you know, if you look at Costco, for example, it's up 60% this year, and it's got a price per earning ratio of 61. Now, if you compare that to Alibaba in China, well, it's up, you know, just 15%, and its price per earning is 17. So it's massively undervalued compared to, you know, Costco. And the other big thing is, you know, just last week, we're seeing that the China government, you know, they're starting to talk now about massive stimulus. And even though Trump has threatened to use tariffs on China, I think he's likely using that as a negotiation tool. He's definitely going to put some tariffs on, but I'm expecting that the tariffs that actually get put on are not going to be anywhere near as extreme as everybody's been expecting. So if you combine all that, and when you look at a chart of Costco and compare it to a chart of Alibaba, the Alibaba chart to me looks like it's formed the bottom, and that has my attention because I think the upside there could be pretty significant.
We know you had an amazing Black Friday special a couple of weeks ago. Any chance you could extend that for our listeners?
Yeah, we could do that. Let's see, that was a big one. So that we gave that was between 33% and 57% off. Now we have three paid services. So we have the Trend Letter. That's a weekly publication, covers all sectors: equities, currencies, precious metals, commodities, bonds. Our Trend Technical Trader, so that's an online service, updates every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. That's for investors that are looking for a little bit more active trading, not day trading per se, but just a bit more active, which is good for this time, you know, these kind of markets. It used to be a hedging service, but it covers both short and long positions. It includes also the Gold Technical Indicator, which is our proprietary service. And then we have Trend Disruptors, so that's speculative for, you know, high-risk capital. And again, that's for AI, virtual reality, you know, 5G, et cetera. So if you 33% off any one of those, and if you start bundling them up, if you actually bundled all three of them, you would get, I think it's 57% off the total price. So those are some good deals. We also have our free service, Jim. That's when we, you know, every morning, we send out headlines. It's called headlines. So we send out headlines that we feel investors should be aware of. And then the reader can simply read the headlines. So it only takes them a couple minutes. And if they want the actual details of that particular headline, they can just simply click on the link and read the article.
Can you tell our listeners about your three services, the Trend Letter, Trend Technical Trader, and Trend Disruptors, and how people can get more information?
Yeah. So I think I just kind of went over those right there. So They can simply, you know, email us at info@thetrendletter.com or just go to the website, thetrendletter.com, and take a look around. And then, yeah, if they've got any questions about, I'll leave that Black Friday special up. I'll post a link on our main page. Maybe we'll just put your logo up there so they know. And we'll leave that up for the next few days. We can't leave those up that long. And so, they can, you know, if they got any questions about what our services are, just at info@thetrendletter.com, browse around. And if you want to buy one of those services, you want to subscribe, just click on that link.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Hey, Jim, always a pleasure. Hey, and Merry Christmas. Happy holidays to you and all your listeners.
My guest has been Martin Strath, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. He was speaking to us from Coquitlam, BC. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Hilliard Macbeth, and Martin Strath. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next week.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.